D'accord.
It's good to be with you all tonight. I'm excited. We're in the third part of a series. I'm going to jump right into it tonight. My contention tonight is that we live in a culture that's highly mobile. That we live in a culture of mobility, which is a significant change from the way that humanity has understood itself in terms of in relation to each other and the environment. In other words, humanity has grown in pockets and communities of places where people generally don't have a lot of contact between the communities, and so communities are stabilized over a long period of time. But in the middle of the 19th century, with the advent of things like the Intercontinental Railroad and the development of transportation systems, the interstate highway system, we began to have a country in a world that began to be accessed at any point by anyone whenever they so desired. And so it's changed the way we understand ourselves. Because we are only a 12-hour road trip from somebody who lives on the other side of the country. But that's also had a number of effects on us. You know, one of the things that's been an interesting case study in the last couple months, well, let me just ask this. How many of you out there are KU Jayhawks? How many of you are not? Setting myself up there. It was amazing to watch, what was it, a month ago when Roy Williams made the decision to be mobile. Right? Did some of you listen to sports talk? To listen to the raging and powerful debates as to the nature of community, loyalty, what it means to be in a community, and what claims of loyalty those communities have on individuals, was a pretty profound, I think, pulse of where we find ourselves as a culture. In other words, we all want to be surrounded with people who stay with us over the long haul. But I think in many ways, those of us who were critical of Roy Williams and the process that he went through to make his decision were a tad bit hypocritical. Because the reality is in a culture that's highly mobile, we make decisions based on what is good for us. And we get up and leave whenever we choose to do so. See, I believe that as a culture, we have been trained to move. We have been taught that it is normative to have a pace of life that continually separates us from people around us. You know, one of the things that's curious about the last century, when you study the development of the way children are educated, was this idea of separating children from their families to be educated and educating them with like-aged kids. See, in the 20th century, we've got the development and the invention of this idea of generations. Whereas many groups of people in a broad degree of age ranges would do their lives by and large together, one of the fruit of the 20th century has been segmentation of population. It's particularly along age ranges. See, when the Bible talks about generation, the term generation in the Bible would mean all those people that were alive at the same time. Not the segmented age groups within an age. You see what I'm saying? So to be in a generation, to be called part of a wicked and adulterous generation, would be to be lumped into that community of people that were alive at any one given point. But see, marketers and advertisers have learned very quickly that if you can tell people how they are different than and better than another group of people, they become a very powerful consuming segment of the population, right? And so we define ourselves often by who we're not like. We've been trained to disconnect ourselves from one another along what I believe are fairly artificial lines. You know, one of the things I heard a colleague and friend of mine, a guy named Andy Crouch, who's the editor of a magazine called Regeneration Quarterly, do a discussion on some of the ways our culture has changed. And one of the things he says about the economy that we find ourselves in now is that for this economy to work, we need a highly educated and highly mobile workforce. Group of people that have a common breadth of information and knowledge that can up and reroute themselves to any place in the country. And one of the observations that he made in this discussion was that was in fact what college is designed to do. to take children and people and separate them from their families and educate them in a context of people just like them away from homes so that then they would be able to move at any place to fill a labor-intensive need, which is a very interesting comment. I'm not sure what to make of it. So I think as a culture, we have been trained to disconnect and to separate ourselves based on how we're different from other people. Another way is I think that we've been trained as humans to prefer that which is novel to that which is known. In other words, one of the things that I think that we struggle with as a group of people is the issue of boredom. We are highly stimulated. You know what the word amusement means? Without inspiration. The root word being muse, inspire, ah meaning without. To be amused means to live your life without inspiration. And yet in many ways we have a culture of trivia and amusement. Where we are constantly waiting the release of a next movie, right? Where we are constantly waiting for the next promotion. Where we are constantly scanning the horizon for the next relationship that will stimulate us in a way that we've kind of lost hold of in the ones that we currently possess. We like that which is new over that which is known. And I think that causes in us a pattern of upheaval. When Mimi and I were living in Denver, I went there to go to seminary, and one of the things that was very challenging and intriguing about living in Denver is that Denver is a transient community. Have any of you ever been in Denver? It's a very young community, and what we learned when we lived there was a group of people that were constantly shuffling in and out of Denver because it was a great town to live in. And then there was a segment of the population that were natives. Have you all been to Colorado and seen native bumper stickers? See, this is a reaction to the reality of an environmental stimulus. In the face of so much transition, we have to mark ourselves as people who stay. And what I learned living among people who were both transient and natives was that it was incredibly hard to penetrate the native population. You just don't want to let people in because you know what? They're going to be gone. And I was a part of a church plant there that sought to reach Generation X people in the Washington Park area, and one of the most difficult things in the world to do among a transient young population was to foment any sense of community, because you'd have people for about 2 weeks to a month and a half, and then they'd be gone. Every time you looked out at the church, it was constantly reinventing itself, because the people were just constantly moving through. Because I think that we have a culture that has trained us to prefer what is novel over that which is known. The third last thing that I would say with regard to this culture of mobility is not only have we been trained to move and to separate and to prefer that which is novel to that which is known, is that we've been trained to consume. And I've talked about this a lot. But the way and the metaphor with which we understand our identity as human beings is that we are primarily consumers. And a subset of that, as a human being, you are generally valued based on what you produce. And you're a part of a machine that seeks to give you value based on, number one, how much you produce and the value of what you're producing, and then number two, how much you consume. What was the song we sang tonight? I am seeking true identity in the light of your presence. See, this is a different way of securing identity than the one our culture gives us. We seek true identity, or we don't even seek true identity, we seek identity based on externals. The measuring sticks that our culture gives us. And so folks, when I'm talking about having a culture of mobility that is at war with our discipleship, our ability to follow Jesus Christ and be among His people over the long haul, these things work against us. Because it generates in us, even in our spiritual life, even in our discipleship, this question, what have you done for me lately? Right. And so we see church as just simply one more place where we go to consume a spiritual product. And as long as this church continues to meet my spiritual needs, then I go here and I pay my tithe or my entrance fee to get a product. And when I no longer get my needs met there, then I go find a place where my needs can be met. And folks, that is decimating the church in our culture. Because community has no power when we live our lives in the short term. What have you done for me lately? Then we move on. See, I believe that mobility is the opposite of community. But here's the problem. In our culture, and I would say even in our Christian culture, mobility always trumps community. Mobility always trumps community. Because we've defined ourselves primarily as individuals and not as a people, and as consumers and not as disciples. I shared a couple weeks ago that one of my favorite Old Testament scholars, a guy named Walter Brueggemann, says there are two competing stories in America, maybe more. But he says one is the story of consumerism, and it's mediated by the TV. The second is the story of the gospel, which is mediated by the church. And see, we are having to decide which story we are going to live our lives under. The story of the gospel with his people, or the story of consumption mediated by TV and the broader culture. See, I think we value individualism, freedom, and choice. But at the same time, we complain of loneliness, isolation, and meaninglessness. Do you understand that these things have a cause and effect relationship? That where individualism, freedom, and choice reigns, meaninglessness, loneliness, and isolation are sure to follow. One of my good friends was in town last week. He's the pastor of a church in London, a Sutton Vineyard. His name is Jason Clark, and he was here last Sunday night, and he spoke here last October. And one of the things that he's talked about is he's got a church where over 60% of the people at the church are new Christians, and he's trying to talk to them about what it means to follow Jesus. And what's often been a struggle for him is people begin to live their life in the midst of this community of people, and then an opportunity comes around, and they find a house on the beach that is their dream house. And so they, without ever talking to anybody, blow up their community and go move far away and then try to figure out why they don't have friends. Why all of a sudden their vibrant life in God has hit a stagnation point. Because mobility and our desire for individual freedom and choice always trumps community. See, it's my contention, and this is what we began to talk about last week, proximity. That place matters. That these things are not addendums to discipleship, but they are part and parcel of what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. And what I'm going to add tonight, in addition to the fact that place matters, I'm going to say this: so does consistency over time. You cannot grow in the way that God desires for you to grow into the image of His Son and have any level of intimacy with Christ and impact both individually and externally on others when mobility is the chief characteristic of our lives. Place matters, and so does consistency over time. So here we are. We're in the second week of this series, and the series, in case you haven't been a part of it so far, has been the idea of exploring what it would look like for our community to have what's called a rule of life. Okay, now some of you ought to be like the RCA dog and go, because that's not a word we use a whole lot. But it has been my contention that a rule of life is a way of living that is common to a group of people. And it is my contention that if you look at the history of faith and Christianity in particular, especially as it's tied to Hebrew faith, that it is normative in the history of faith that a community of people would have a common way of living. That faith wouldn't be just what we believe, but it would be what we do. And yet oftentimes we talk about what we would need to do to grow closer to God, but many of the things that would support that over a long period of time are absent in our life. In other words, living our life of faith out in nearness to somebody else. Tonight I'm talking about living our life out over time with the same group of people. I'd like to share with you an excerpt from this book that we're going to midrash on, the story we find ourselves in. In it, Brian McLaren talks about his reading of the scriptures, and he defines the scriptural stories in broad arcs. And at one point, when talking about the church, he talks about community. Now listen to how he describes the idea of the church. Jesus called people to follow him, to be his disciples. The word disciple means learner. A disciple wants to know and to do what the teacher knows and does. So we apprentice ourselves to that teacher. With me so far? Jesus was creating a community of followers. A disciple is a follower of Jesus. And there was a way of living. A disciple is a follower of Jesus. And there was a way of living as a disciple. Later, they got the nickname Christian, which means little Christ or mini Messiah. And their way of living became known as Christianity, which might better be called a messianic way of living. Isn't that good? To be a Christ follower would be to live in a messianic way. They were disciples, which speaks of being called together to learn and to follow Jesus. There were also apostles who would be sent out to practice and teach what they had learned. This is what apostle means, a person who is sent on a mission. So Jesus brings together this community of men and women who are called out from the crowds to be disciples. Do you understand your discipleship in this way? That Jesus has called you out from a crowd to be a learner, to be apprenticed in his way of life, his messianic way of living in this present reality. And these disciples will then be sent back into the world on a message, on a mission of expressing Jesus' message of God's kingdom and helping others become disciples who will in turn help others, and so on and so on and so on. I love that. This idea that to be a follower of Jesus Christ, to be a Christian, is not any more complicated than saying, Lord, I am submitting to you as a learner. I am apprenticing myself to you. And by default, that means submitting myself to a community of people where I will, as Paul says, work out my salvation with fear and trembling. And that together we will live out messianically a way of life that is expansive, that is not for our own sake, but for the sake of the world. I think it's a very compelling picture. See, my contention is that high mobility decimates biblical discipleship. Because ultimately, in my mind, the kingdom of God is about developing relationships. The kind of relationships that are eternal now and will last for eternity. With God and with other people and with the world. And folks, if our lifestyles do not support the development of relationships over time, then we are killing ourselves in our faith lives. We cannot be and we cannot do what God intends for us to be and do. And so what is the alternative? What is the alternative to a high level of mobility? Well, I would like to suggest that we discover an ancient word called stability. In fact, I want to go back 1,500 years to get some clues about what is missing in our current culture of mobility. I'd like to read from a passage. I cracked this out a couple weeks ago. This is called the Rule of Saint Benedict. And this is a way of doing life for a community of people that is 1,500 years old. Now, here's what's amazing. At the beginning, Benedict introduces his rule of life. And he has this very interesting thing to say. And I want you to listen closely because he's going to describe four different kinds of people who live in and around monasteries. And I want you to listen to how close it mirrors the reality of Christianity today. Okay? There are clearly four kinds of monks. First, there are the Cenobites. That's a doesn't matter what that means. That is to say, those who belong to a monastery where they serve under a rule, under a way of life, and an abbot. So the first designation is a group of people who live consistently in one place, under authority, and with a way of life. Okay? Then he goes on, and I'm not going to read this second one, but he talks about hermits who are also a certain kind of monastic person. Then he says, third, there are the Sarabites, the most detestable kind of monks, who with no experience to guide them, no rule to try them, as gold is tried in a furnace, have character as soft as lead. Still loyal to the world by their actions, they clearly lie to God by their tonsure. In other words, they have a certain kind of haircut that says they're a monk, but they're saying their lives don't match their profession. Two or three gather together, or even alone without a shepherd. They pen themselves up in their own sheepfolds, not the Lord's. Their law is what they like to do, whatever strikes their fancy. Anything they believe in and choose, they call holy. Anything they dislike, they consider forbidden. See, I meet people like this all the time. Hey man, I'm a Christian, but I don't need church. I just have a few people I hang out with, and we kind of do what we want. But you know, church, it's screwed up. And it screwed me up. So I don't need to be under authority. I'm on my own. I'm out there doing it. Those people existed 1,500 years ago. Okay, last one. Fourth and finally, there are monks called the... I have no idea what this word is. Gyrovagues. Who spend their entire lives drifting from region to region. Or we might say from church to church. Staying as guests there for 3 or 4 days in different monasteries. Always on the move, they never settle down, and they are slaves to their own wills and gross appetites. In every way, they are worse than Sarabites. Isn't that amazing? Benedict, 1,500 years ago, describing a church culture that I find very similar to the one that we find ourselves in today. It's amazing to me how little things have changed. And so Benedict's answer, what we're talking about tonight, would be that these men and women who long to follow God would make a vow of stability. They would say, for better or for worse, this is where I will live out my life of faith. Because I believe God has set me in a specific place under specific people to do things in me that couldn't be done on my own. You know, this is not a sexy message tonight. It's not real flashy. Because you know what we're talking about tonight? We're talking about the aspects of discipleship that are represented by words like faithfulness, obedience, and perseverance. The idea of being in relationship with people over a long period of time. Sharing life in such a way that God can really challenge us. What is stability? Number one, I think stability is being intentional. It's being intentional about who we are and the decisions we make about how we will do our life. There's a book out right now. I have not read it, but it's really high on Christian bestseller list, and it's even making a mark on the New York Times list. Have you all seen it? It's called The Purpose-Driven Life, by a guy named Rick Warren. Basically what he's saying is that God has an intent for our lives. That our lives would not just be lived willy-nilly, spread out all over the map. But that we would think about who we are and where we want to go and how we might get there and the means that we might submit ourselves to achieve those ends. You know, about 10 years ago, I had somebody ask me the question, Tim, when you die, what would you like to be said about you at your funeral? Have you ever had an exercise like that? Where you begin with the end in mind and then work backwards to say, what kind of human being does that mean I have to be now? See, I think this is significant in our lives, you guys. Being intentional about the decisions we make about where we will live out our life. In the monastic communities, what that often means is there's a period of examination that monks go under where they examine the community that they're about to be a part of, and the community examines them, and they say, hey, should we live our lives together? Because this is it from here on out. Now, am I suggesting that that's what we do at Jacob's Well? We create this gauntlet? Well, some churches do that. That's called membership. And we have not done that. But what does it mean to actually be intentional about where you're living your life out? In faith, to actually think about, where do I want to go and what does that mean for me now? Where will I live? With whom will I share life? You know, that's a critical question because we have a young church. Many people under 30 who are making significant life decisions. Do you know that the life decisions you make now will either bless you or haunt you the rest of your life? It doesn't seem quite fair, does it? But you know what? God never intended us to have to make those decisions on our own either. That this is what families and church communities would help do. Walk through life transitions and passages together. Something that's also impossible to do when we're moving around without being known in any one of those places. It means we make commitments with our eyes open. You know, I'm going to draw a little picture in the air, okay? I do a lot of premarital counseling with people. Okay? And here's often what happens. Okay, here's a circle. What was that, Grover? Be nice if this little blue ring showed up here. Okay, circle right here. This is the person that you really are. Okay? Now, go out 6 or 10 inches. I'm going to draw another circle around it, right? This is the person that you project to the world. Right? With me on that? Okay, now over here, okay, this is a man. Here's a woman. This is all her hidden stuff, all her brokenness, all her fears. And then, the part of her that she projects to the world. Here's what happens in pre-marriage counseling. This inner person thinks they're marrying this outward projection. And this inner person, with all their brokenness, thinks that they're marrying this outward projection. And then they get married and all hell breaks loose. My goal in premarital counseling is to get this person married to this person. In the same way, folks, if you come to Jacob's Well and you see a Sunday night service that's very impressive or whatever it is, that's not us. It's part of us. But you don't know us unless you know our people. We are a church of individuals and we are a church of a community. Kurt is Jacob's Well. Jacob's Well is not this space. And so when we make commitments about where we're going to live our life of faith out, what we really need to do is go in with our eyes open saying that this is who I am and who are you, and let's have some dialogue. Because this counts. This is for keeps. Now don't hear me wrong. Wherever you are in your journey to God, and wherever that involves Jacob's Well, we are very glad to have you here. Whether you're just walking in the door, whether you're hanging out exploring God, us, whatever, whether you've been a follower for a long time and this is your home, there is no inner circle Illuminati group at Jacob's Well. That if you've ultimately progressed, then this will be true and this won't be true. We're a community of people. What I'm seeking to do is figure out what it looks like for us to really be freed up in our discipleship to follow God wherever He leads us. So wherever you are in your journey, all I'm interested in is whether or not you are willing to take the next step of obedience. Because Jesus doesn't say, decide for me. He says what? Follow me. And that implies movement. So if you are here tonight seeking to follow Jesus, chances are there's a next step coming. How will I live my life? Will I be intentional about it? Will I live with the end in mind? Okay, being intentional, one aspect of stability. Second, live giving your word. Words matter. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. So when you make a promise to God, and I would add based on what Jesus teaches, and to others, don't delay in following through, for God takes no pleasure in fools. Keep all the promises you make to Him. It is better to say nothing than to promise something that you don't intend to follow through on. In such cases, your mouth is making you sin. See, I think we often give our word for things. We say we'll be a part. We say we'll belong. But what we really mean is as long as it benefits me. Jesus in Matthew chapter 5 talking about vows, and not the kind of vows where we make promises, but the kind of vows where we get other people to do what we want them to do by saying, "By God, I," says this: just say a simple, "Yes, I will," or "No, I won't." Your word is enough. To strengthen your promise with a vow shows that something is wrong. All I'm trying to get at this by this is that words matter, and that we as people speak what we believe. And so if you are being intentional about your life, and you are saying, "Here I am, and here is where I will do my faith," your words mean something. They matter. Let your yes be yes. Last thing I think about when I think about stability is this idea of living in harmony with our intention and our words. In other words, it's one thing to say, "I want to live this way." It's another thing to give our word that we're going to do something. It's a third thing to persevere and have integrity and follow through on it, right? To live out our life, to be faithful and to persevere. Eugene Peterson is a pastor who's a big hero of mine, and he wrote a book on discipleship, and he quotes a passage from Nietzsche, who he takes it out of the context of Nietzsche, but he thinks it gives a good picture of what discipleship is. And he defines discipleship in these terms: a long obedience in the same direction. Discipleship, a way of living, is a long obedience along a certain path, going the same way and hopefully with other people alongside. You know, this is significant for me because, you know what, folks? The reason I preach about this is not the type of guy I am. You know, when I was in college, I changed majors a couple times because I continued to get bored. I eventually landed on one because I just didn't want to spend any more money. But if you looked at my life in my 20s, here is the pattern you would see in my life. And I would say that this is not atypical or even bad for a 20-year-old. But when it becomes a pattern, it continues to be emulating, then it becomes dangerous. I had about a 3-year attention span on things. I would go into something and become enamored of it, like the challenge of doing something, and then when the challenge would begin to wane, I would begin to scan the horizon for the next thing. And I think many of us struggle that way in relationships as well. In fact, this was actually reinforced to me when I went to seminary. We had to take this ministry assessment called the IDAC, which seeks to identify things in you that will help you to know what you ought to do professionally. And one of the things they measure is for those people who happen to have leadership or supervisory gifts, they said people usually express those gifts in one of three ways, and they're usually mutually exclusive. The first is an entrepreneurial style of leadership, which is a developer-initiator. The second is like a long-term planner that takes initial ideas and then put legs on them and helps them get to the next step. And the third is a manager, somebody who doesn't invent new things. They just take something that exists and they just make it run. And so he said, listen, if you have a leadership gift, then chances are you will do it in one of those three ways and probably not the other two. And so guess where I scored off the chart? Developer, initiator, entrepreneur. And so it reinforced the pattern that I had lived in my life. I like to go into areas where things haven't started, start them, get them going, get them running, and then move on. And so my picture of Jacob's well 4 years ago is that I would come in and get this baby going. And in about 3 or 4 years, when this thing was up and going, the church would hire another pastor and I'd go and do something else. I'd be apostolic. Not that there's something wrong with that, but you know what it caused me to do, folks? Hold back relationally. And about 3 years ago, I began to visit this monastery regularly, and I began to explore the Benedictine spirituality, and I began to hear about things that I didn't hear anywhere else, this idea of stability. And at one point, I got really convicted, and I got down on my knees, and I said, "God, for better or for worse, I will do my life at Jacob's Well. I am not going anywhere else. This is my home. These are my people. This is my family. This is where I will do my life." It changed me. Not everybody's called to do that here, do that now. But folks, you know what the impact of stability is? We can't do anything when we're constantly having to reinvent ourselves because everybody's always brand new. You know, one of the things, if you visited Europe, you see these beautiful cathedrals. You know what's amazing about those cathedrals? It took multiple generations of people to build them. Do you understand that people gave their whole lives to doing something that they wouldn't see the fruit of? What if God has a vision for our community that is bigger than what we would see happen in our life? Do we have a mentality that we would give ourselves to something, to Jesus, and that He would manifest Himself to us, and that He would do something that would take all of our lives to begin and not even see the fruit of? Do we think in those terms, or do we think in American terms, where we build a Walmart and when we need a bigger one, we just tear it down? I want to be a church that is building cathedrals. You know, we talked a couple months ago about dreams. And people have asked me, what am I supposed to do with that? You know what my experience is with dreams, folks? That it takes a long time for dreams to come to fruition. Jacob's Well is about a 12-year dream of mine and some other people's as well. I think about God's dream that He gave Abraham, that he'd be the father of a great nation, and the amount of time that Abraham had to labor before God. See, if we are living our lives together in the path of Christ over a long period of time, then as God books our life together, as the Spirit informs our dreams, as we begin to submit ourselves to one another, as we begin to depend on God and pray and wait on Him, not passively but actively, leaning forward, scanning the horizon, looking for any movement of His Spirit that we might latch on to, then all of a sudden, possibilities open up everywhere. But if we sit here and say, you've got 2 months to show me your stuff, and then I'm gone, nothing will ever happen. And not only that, but our characters will never be transformed into the likeness of Christ. I've said this before, I'll say it again. God speaks to me, God meets my needs, God confronts me in my sin, not by magical voices out of the heavens, but by people who know me as flesh and blood Tim. That God speaks to me most significantly through other people who have known me over a long period of time. That He is producing holiness in me. That He is sanctifying me, not by my own efforts, but through this Spirit, by grace, in the context of this community of people. And so I would ask you tonight, what are your intentions for your life? How do you define your identity? Do you see yourself primarily as a consumer and a producer or as a disciple? And if you are a disciple, where will you live out your faith? With what people will you walk the path behind Jesus? How will you do that? See, it is my belief that our tired, worn out way of doing Christianity, well, that it's time to discover something new. Not by rejecting what's come before, but by latching on to that which has been left behind and reappropriating it. By rejecting a story of what it means to be a human being that has been mediated by our culture, and to begin to accept Jesus' way of doing life. Huh? Let's pray. Jesus, we thank You for the opportunity to gather us together tonight. And Father, I am grateful for this community of people, this church, these people who have submitted themselves to You and to one another. They've said, Jesus, where You go, we will follow. And we will do that together. Lord, we pray that You would increase our life here together. And that, Father, as we live our lives out here before You, as we submit to You, as we depend on Your grace, as we share our lives together, Lord, would You take what we've done and increase it? Would You invite more people, Lord, to know You? To walk Your path, Lord? To depend on You? And Father, would You help us to develop characteristics through your spirit, like faithfulness and obedience and perseverance. Father, that we may walk along obedience in the same direction. Just as you, Lord, walked along obedience in the same direction to the cross. And not just to the cross, but to earth, where you would show us how to live. It's in your name we pray, Jesus. Amen.